Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
To me, I have a feeling that probably Teresa knew what was going on. I asked my mother one time, because my mother is the only link that I had between them. And I asked her, I said, Mom, do you think that Teresa left because of the molestation? And she said, I've wondered that. I've thought that myself. Well, my granddaughter told us about him molesting her. This is a one-time thing that he did to her, but the ones down there in McAllister and Hartshorn, it was an ongoing thing. But we happened to be there because, the time period was my grandmother had passed away, and we had the funeral. And that evening, they were all over at Melissa's house, and that's when he took it upon himself to sit with the little kids right in front of the mothers, playing cards and doing this, whatever. And he's over there messing with the little kids. I called him on it. I called him when he was in San Diego, and I just put it out there. I said, you were messing with her and the other kids. He said, yeah, I did it. He admitted it to me. I was lost for words. I thought he would lie to me about it. So then I asked him, I said, Joey, are you doing this to your daughter too? Beth wasn't born. Oh, no, no, he said, I wouldn't do that to her. Whether he did or not, I don't know that. Then he said, I am seeing a counselor about it. Well, about a week or so later, the DHS in McAllister said that they got a call from someone, some counselor, about the molestation, and they went and talked to the kids, and I wasn't involved in that. I was just told about that. And the only thing that the DHS did was just to tell them to stay away from him. No charges were brought.
Yesterday, we brought you the first part of the unbelievable disappearance of Teresa Kennedy and her then 3-year-old daughter, Bethany. After years of thinking that Teresa and Bethany had vanished, with no indications that they were alive, a letter was discovered that changed everything and raised the distinct possibility that they may be out there somewhere, living in hiding. This is the rest of their story, and it's one that will grip you to the very end. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 337 of The Vanished, part 2 of Teresa Kennedy and Bethany Tyner's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. We started yesterday's episode with the following warning, but I wanted to reiterate that this series of episodes is more graphic than most of our stories. These episodes contain detailed descriptions of adult subject matter, including alleged child sexual abuse. Please take care while listening. We also mentioned yesterday that these episodes contain interviews with family members about a person accused of felony criminal offenses. We would like to reiterate that anyone accused of a crime in the United States who has not pled guilty or been convicted of the alleged offense remains innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, with constitutional protections to a fair trial and due process. We hold no opinion about any person's innocence or guilt, and are not qualified to give legal opinions or advice. You heard us discuss in part one that Joe Tyner is Catherine and Bethany's father, and he was married to Teresa prior to her disappearance. But who was the man that Teresa wrote a letter indicating was abusing her little girl? Joe's sister Shirley explained to us some of the family dynamic involving Joe.
My brother's always been one of those that's been kept from us, or he kept himself from us girls. I don't know why. And me and my sister, my oldest sister, I'm 19 years older than Joe, and she's 21 years older than Joe. And then me and Melissa are 16 years apart. But Melissa's always, you know, just, we're her sisters. And Joey never wanted to be our brother. And after the years went by, you know, as he got older, they lived overseas a lot. And Melissa and Joey and Mom and Daddy, when Daddy worked in oil fields. But as he got older, he just kept, even after he married Teresa, he didn't come around that much.
Joe's sister Darlene told us more about the family dynamic, which she believes may have enabled Joe Tyner over the years.
Joey is the kind of person that is privileged, and he can do whatever he wants as long as his mother will get him out of trouble. My mother was so controlling. She controlled everything. She controlled us kids, what we liked or didn't like. Joey tried to break out of it, but I don't think he ever did. I think that he has a love-hate relationship with his mother. They made him more special and told him he was more special. And in one instance, Mama even told all the kids, he is your uncle. You're supposed to do what he tells you to do. Really. Well, that set up an abuse, didn't it? And it just had to be her way. And even if it was totally off the wall and you knew that was wrong, it still was right to Mama. We call her Mama. He calls her Mother. She separated Joey from all the rest. Joey has never had anything to do with me or Shirley, or that much to do with Melissa. And I know she keeps saying, Mama keeps saying, well, Melissa, you were raised with him, which just goes through Melissa. She gets so mad about that. Even though she was raised with Joey, she knew that he took precedent over everything in that family. What Joey wanted, he got. And of course, Mama says, well, Daddy just took him around and let him buy whatever he wanted to. I think it was to bring peace.
Our work on this case began in the summer of 2021. But as we started to conduct interviews and talk with family members, we felt like we needed to hit pause on production of the podcast in order to address disturbing allegations that carried a risk of active and ongoing child sexual abuse being perpetrated at the time we were researching a missing mother and daughter. Multiple family members told us that they had been victims of or witnessed to Joe Tyner's sexual abuse of children in his family, including his own children as well as extended relatives. This was already corroborated by the letter found by Teresa's family, written in 1996, prior to her disappearance. As we interviewed Joe's own family, we learned that the allegations being made against Joe in the last few years weren't the first time he'd been accused of engaging in sexual acts with a minor. Here's Joe's sister Melissa on that.
My brother said to me, and he said it to me more than once. Apparently, he said it to me a long time ago because my niece, who is my oldest sister's daughter, she reminded me that when this all happened back in 1990, when the first allegations came out and he admitted to messing with the girls, several of them, she reminded me that he told me back then, you know why. You know why. Well, I didn't remember that. Back in April, when he and I had the huge fight on the phone, he told me then, he said, one of these days, I want to sit down with you and tell you why I am the way I am. And I remember thinking at the time, dude, I don't want to know. because sometimes I get so angry. It's like, you make your own choices in life. You know right from wrong. You can make choices. Okay? You can seek help. And if you choose not to, then you know better, by gosh. So he said it to me again on the phone when we got into a huge, huge fight. And I said, you know what? I don't want to know. He said, you know why I am the way I am. And I said, I have not a clue what you're talking. And I don't, still don't. My niece, she called me and she said, I have a question for you. I said, what? She said, do you know what he's talking about? I said, I don't. I said, I swear to the Lord, I don't know what he's talking about. Because if I did, I would say it. But I have no clue. I've raked my brain trying to figure out what he's talking about. When my told me what he did about my father, the only thing I could think of was maybe that's what he's talking about, is that he was molested by daddy. But why would he say that I know? That's what I don't understand, because there was the allegations against my dad by the girls.
Melissa not only told us that Joe directly shared with her what he had done and who the victims were, but also that he may have been doing it because he had been sexually abused by their father. Intergenerational violence is a pattern often seen among offenders convicted of sex offenses. However, that doesn't lessen the trauma endured by each victim, nor does it reduce the seriousness of the offenses perpetrated by those who were also victimized. The clip that you heard at the beginning of this episode was Darlene discussing a time when a counselor reported Joe. DHS investigated, but no charges were filed. They were just told to stay away from Joe. This experience must have been extremely traumatic and invalidating to the victims who had bravely shared their stories. But to make matters worse, Shirley told us that instead of protecting the children, certain family members made an effort to hide the truth and protect Joe.
He was going to a counselor. Evidently, they said it was a marriage counselor. They had to turn it in, and they sent it here to the Pittsburgh County DHS in McAllister. And my sister had found out from her granddaughter what had happened to her. Her and Joey talked. Joey admitted it. My daughter and her husband, the DHS, with a police officer, came that night after it was reported to them and woke them, had to get the girls out of bed to ask them about what was going on. There was a drop in something there that I don't know what happened, but nothing happened to them. They told her, you keep your girls away from him. And my daughter did. But we went out to tell Mama, me and Melissa, I don't know if she told you, we went out to tell Mom and Daddy so they wouldn't be surprised, because we were going, Mama, we don't know what's going to happen, but this is what Joey did. And he's admitted it. They got mad at us. Oh, my God, it backfired on us. And it's like, you can't tell. It's no big deal. They were just touched, and it's like crap. And after a while, then it was come out that my dad had done something. Well, I shut everything down. They wanted everybody to write letters to say it didn't happen, that it was not happening. I said, I ain't doing it. My daughters aren't writing. My daughter and my granddaughter ain't writing nothing. I was seeing a counselor at a Baptist church. You know, I confided in him. He said, would it be true if you wrote and said it didn't happen? If they wrote and said it didn't happen? I said, no, it would be a lie to just suffice them, to make them feel better. He said, then I don't think you should do it. And I said, I don't either. And I told my daughter, you don't dare to write a letter. I didn't see my mom and dad for 2 years.
Melissa told us about some of the events that happened more recently, with renewed allegations against Joe, and the events that were set into motion by them. You will hear quite a few names bleeped out in the following clip and throughout this episode. This was done to protect the privacy of the alleged victims in this case.
Catherine, my brother's oldest daughter, they were fixing to move from wherever they were living up in Northeast somewhere to Germany because her husband's in the service. And I guess she must have been in contact with and told her everything. Catherine didn't know. She knew none of it. She didn't know anything about any of the abuse because our family didn't talk about it. Everything that happened back in 1990-something or whenever it was, the family just pushed it under a rug and didn't talk about it. I've always wondered about Kathy. I've always worried about Kathy, like, if he did something to her. But she told me, she said, I don't ever remember him doing anything inappropriate with me. She wrote a letter to the family back in early April, March or April. She wrote a letter to the family saying, hey, I just found all this stuff out about my father, and I don't want to have anything to do with him. And I really don't want to have anything to do with anybody who's harbored him or protected him or anything like that. What she didn't understand was that my mother was a big part of that. But my mom also became a mother to Catherine after Teresa left with Beth. So Kathy looks back on my mom. I think she understands now how that my mom covered it up and how that my mom, you might as well say enabled, but didn't do anything about it. My mom is 93 and she has dementia from Alzheimer's. So she's at a point where it doesn't matter if you talk to her, she ain't going to remember it tomorrow anyway. And my sisters and I have a real rough time with that because we're all very angry with her. And I didn't realize how angry I was because I just got back from going down to Oklahoma and staying about 4 days. And I came home an emotional wreck. Back in April, when this whole thing like broke apart again, and then my brother and I got into a huge fight and because of what he did. So I spoke with Colton Westbrook. He is the investigator in Pittsburgh County, and he did not get to interview my brother. He tried. And he called him on the phone, and he's like, I need to meet up with you and everything. My brother ended up getting money from my mom. He got $5,000 out of a bank account, and he hired a lawyer. So when Colton Westbrook showed up at my brother's place out in Hartshorne with DHS because they wanted to check on because there was some stuff said about, and when they did, Tim Mackey was standing on the front porch of my brother's place and would not let him talk to the police. You know, now DHS went in and actually took out of the home and did interviews with him. Kelly was saying, well, I hope you're happy now. You know, they took out and they're asking him all sorts of questions and stuff like that.
So it was this letter that Catherine wrote to her family that basically opened the floodgates. Catherine's step-sibling had confided in her about the alleged abuse she endured. But then others started to come forward too. Another one of Joe's sisters, Darlene, had her own thoughts about what was going on after information started to trickle through the Tyner family about more and more victims of his abuse.
Joey and Kelly have moved around so much. I didn't keep up with it that much. I know when they moved back to Hartshorne, then they were in Fort Worth, Chickasha, and in Florida, and there was some stuff said about Florida, too. Catherine hasn't spoke to her daddy in quite a while. I know I got a letter from her. Catherine told everybody in that letter that she believed the victims. She believes what the girls are saying. And it's not just one, because I do believe that he was abusing Kelly's girls. Kelly thinks she is a go-between, a peacemaker. Mama called me one time where she had been called at 3 o'clock in the morning, she said, somewhere around 3 o'clock in the morning, and Kelly said to her, he's doing it again, I caught him. And that's all Mama ever told me. But I assumed, okay, I knew what she was talking about. He was molesting her girls again. And then I figured, okay, she's out of there. Listen, I would be. I'm out of there. I'm not going to give him another chance. She should have called cops. But anyway, Mama said later on that Kelly told her she would keep the secret forever. She would never tell anyone and just forget about it or let it go. I don't know about the forgetting about it, but just let it go. It is very frustrating when a girl a small child has been violated in such a way, and the perpetrator is still out there violating and living and breathing. Another thing that he told me at that time when I called him, and this just makes me sick, he said, well, I asked if it was okay if I did that, if it was bothering her just to say, don't do it. And he said, she said, she shook her head, I don't want you to do it. And so I stopped. Are you kidding me? And so he thinks that that makes it okay because he asked her if it's okay. He's sick, is all I can say.
Shirley told us that receiving the letter Catherine wrote to her family and coming forward to condemn her father's behavior changed everything for the Tyner family.
Well, when Kathy was down and he got that letter from Kathy, like I got it from her, it's still on my post in my messenger where she sent me that letter just this last time she come to visit us here before she came, sent it to me in a family text thing, whatever. And she was talking to her Oklahoma family. And what she found out about her dad, she also sent it to him. He ran and got a lawyer. And also that they knew that had went and filed charges on him. That's when he took off and went to Georgia. They had went out there to the house, his house. Nobody was home. Well, they hadn't gotten back from Georgia yet. So they went back out there. And I don't know how all that come about. Joey didn't have to say a word. And I do know that from hearing things that's been said, that told him about pictures that were taken. And to please get the pictures. And the lady at the DHS said, honey, they're gone. He got rid of a lot of stuff. And some of them might have been like Polaroids. I'm just saying, I don't know. And that is so sick. I wonder about his computer. But of course, he can erase things. But there's ways to pull that stuff back up. He's a predator.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on. But when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. We had two big questions that stuck with us throughout our research into this case. First, why was Catherine left behind? And second, why did Joe not abuse her in the way that other victims said that they had been abused? We didn't think Catherine was lying, and she went through intensive treatment for PTSD after we first talked to her in the summer of 2021. So we asked her in our second conversation that took place in March of 2022 why she believes she was treated differently and spared the horrific sexual abuse her sisters and extended relatives endured. Catherine explained that she's thought a lot about this. One theory that she's developed about why she was favored and possibly protected by her grandmother is based on her appearance. Since Catherine was born looking like her father and grandmother, while Bethany looked more like Teresa, who was an indigenous American, they were treated differently, primarily by their grandmother. While that might sound strange and completely wrong, Catherine told us that there's a lot about her family culture that she's still trying to understand and come to terms with.
My father was treated like the savior of my family. He was the boy that they had prayed for so many years. And even though I'm not a boy, and I was not born a boy, I feel like I was treated in a similar way. And I don't 100% understand why. The only explanation that I can sort of come up with is that it had to do with the way that I looked. In my family, the physical traits of red hair and pale skin are very prized. And I came out with red hair and pale skin. And of course, this isn't the way that they say it. They say, oh, you look just like your dad. You look just like your grandma. You look just like your aunt. And it's like this very precious thing to them that they love to talk about. Now, I'm sure you've seen pictures of my sister. She did not come out with pale skin and red hair. So this is my only sort of explanation that I can sort of come up with at all at this point, is that I was the favorite, prized by the whole family because of the way that I looked, because I favored, you know, that side of the family. My sister was more Native American in appearance, and so she wasn't as prized. That's the only thing that I can think of. And it sounds really bizarre for me to say that, but, you know, we've been talking a lot about family culture. One of the things in my family culture is they're very appearance focused. There's a big emphasis on beauty and body weight, and it's really messed with me, but I didn't even really realize as I was growing up that I was the favorite. My grandmother was very like verbally praising of me. Every time she saw me, it was like, you're so pretty, you're so smart. And then she would buy me a bunch of stuff. My dad, he didn't really compliment me that much, only bought me gifts rarely. And honestly, to me, growing up, my dad was just sort of this stable presence. He never really got angry with me. He never really showed a ton of positive emotion either, though. At least as I can recall, he was just sort of like a steady, stable presence. I personally have thought long and hard about whether I have any uncovered memories, and if I do, I haven't uncovered them.
We shared the letter that Teresa wrote in December of 1996. But haven't yet addressed the domino effect it set off in both the Kennedy and Tyner families. Many of the family members weren't fully aware that their own children and grandchildren may have been abused. But once the letter surfaced, it all started to click. Here's Darlene.
Teresa was protecting Beth, a letter that was evidently left, written by Teresa, and found its way into Teresa's mother's items, I guess, after she had passed away, and it was given on down. I'm hearing this from my sister. I've read it too.
We initially spoke to Catherine only 3 days before the letter Teresa wrote was discovered by family members. During our first conversation, Catherine told us she planned to write a letter to her family, and she bravely did, even after the letter her mom wrote surfaced. This is what she told us about that.
The only thing that I know is the letter. I had heard from my stepsisters that he had abused them, but I didn't realize how young. And it wasn't fathomable to me that he could have abused my sister at that time because she was so young. I have asked my therapist about it. You know, when I had Googled it, I saw that oftentimes parents will choose, you know, one child to abuse over another, but I didn't really explain this case because he had chosen multiple children to abuse, and just it's like he only chose me to spare. But I guess, you know, if you want me to postulate or theorize, one hypothesis might be because of his mother, my grandmother. When I spoke to her about this, which this is the only time I ever spoke to her about this, and it was a very like stunted conversation. She was very uncomfortable. My family doesn't like talking about issues. So I told you the last time we spoke that I had written an open letter to my family and told them why I was going back to Oklahoma. I wanted to see my grandmother, but I did not want to see my parents. And I said the reason why, and it sort of stirred up the anthill, and it upset my grandmother, and she called me. And she said that she knew that he had done this. She said that he called her one time because Kelly made him call to tell my grandmother what he had done to. And she had told him, okay, well, just don't do it again. And she also made him promise her that he would never, had never, and would never touch me. So obviously, in retrospect, this piece of the story from my grandmother is incomplete because was far from his first victim. And I also believe that my grandmother knew about at least one of his earlier victims, which was one of them, specifically my cousin. So what I can only try to explain to you is the culture in my family, which is very, I want to say it's a savior-esque, and that my father was treated like the savior of my family. You know, most of my life, everybody was lying to me. Perspective changer for me since we last spoke was this letter that she wrote and how it seems fairly obvious that she and Bethany were the victims. They were on the side of the good, right? They were innocent. And my mother was just trying to protect my sister. And so it just, it seems like such a terrible injustice that, you know, my mother ended up with a warrant for her arrest. My initial perspective of myself as an adult and as a reasonable human being was that I wasn't a very emotional person, that I just didn't have these strong emotions that a lot of people do. And then sort of after looking at my life more objectively, realizing that there might be underlying issues, I reached out to a therapist. And after I laid everything on the table with her, from my mother, to me, I'm a very analytical person, and I had sort of segregated all of my issues into these different buckets. And I had never spoken to any one person, not even a friend, about every single issue altogether. But I don't know, I just kind of felt like it was time.
After talking with my stepsisters and even other members of my family, like my aunts, my cousins, my stepsister was not his first victim. And multiple people knew, dozens of people, extended family. I don't know if there's anybody except for me who didn't know this about him. First of all, that blows my mind that nobody ever did anything. They just kept it quiet. And secondly, it makes me wonder what else was kept quiet. And this whole thing about how my mother just vanished, it really seems to be too simple to me. And I'm not saying that I have any like theories, but I have red flags going off about this, basically.
Until 2019, the year that Catherine turned 30, she had maintained a relationship with her dad, even though it had already become strained over differences in beliefs and choices. We asked her what precipitated the act of cutting off Joe and Kelly, and this is what she told us about that.
My relationship with my father ceased in the summer of 2019, which is when my stepsister called me and let me know that he had abused her and that she was considering pressing charges. And at that time, I told her she should absolutely press charges, and I ceased all contact with my father and my stepmother. to be honest, it wasn't that difficult because I had a rocky relationship with them as a teenager because I started developing my own political ideology fairly early. And I was already questioning their worldview when I was 17 years old, when I moved out, because my relationship with my dad and Kelly was so tumultuous that I couldn't stand to be there anymore. So at that time, I moved out and moved in with my grandmother. After that, I, at the urging of my grandmother, got married very quickly to my husband, to whom I'm still married. And after that point, I didn't really have a relationship with my parents for the next 8 years. I would send my dad emails occasionally, and they would occasionally, not every year, but maybe once every few years, call me on my birthday. And then after my life had settled down and I was more financially stable and my son was old enough to start asking about his grandparents, I decided to reach back out to them, which I believe that was in 2017, which is when I started to think about visiting them. I did a couple of trips where I introduced my son to his grandparents. And it was Christmas of 2018 when I went back to Oklahoma for the first time in 8 years. And when I was in Oklahoma at that time, I was picking up on some major sketchy vibes, to put it one way. I wanted to see everyone, but it seemed as if everyone didn't want to see each other. And I couldn't quite pick up on the reason for the dissension, for the arguments. I couldn't figure out why people were mad at each other. So I ended up that whole trip sort of spreading myself thin, going from my parents' house to my grandmother's house to my sister's house, to my other sister's house. And at one point, two of my sisters, by the way, anytime I say my sisters in this context, it's my stepsisters, had a screaming fight with each other. And I was so lost. I was so confused. I was like, why are they angry? What happened? And nobody would tell me. And I was asking questions. I was like, what's going on here? And nobody would tell me until several months later after I had returned home when called me. And so at that point, when she told me that my dad had abused her, I don't know, I just said, I did have this sort of impulse, like it was kind of unbelievable, but I also had my principles that I always believe women. So I just immediately, I was like, okay, I believe you. Yes, you should pursue charges. You should pursue justice. And I basically at that point just resumed my previous MO, which was to not have contact with my parents. I mean, it was a little bit more awkward that time since I had recently resumed contact with them. I had just seen them for Christmas. And so for several months, my stepmom and my dad were calling me and messaging me. They messaged my business Facebook once or twice. And it was a little bit awkward, but it wasn't anything that I couldn't handle. My grandmother enabled my father financially throughout his entire adult life, based on things that other people have told me and based on her actions. Unfortunately, I never spoke with her about it before she had dementia.
And Catherine wonders, too, if there could be more victims out there beyond the members of her own family.
One thing we haven't even touched on is that my dad was a minister, a Baptist minister for my entire childhood. He didn't stop working for the church until after I moved out. You know, whenever I asked him why he stopped working for a church, his answer was essentially that like there was too much drama and they wouldn't pay him enough money. And he has like specific Bible verses that he likes to reference that are all about how like the church should pay their servants lots of money. But now in retrospect, I have my suspicions about maybe he had abused someone at church, and maybe there were suspicions about him.
Shirley also mentioned this when we spoke with her, and she thinks that this is something that should be investigated further.
He was a music director, worship leader, and every church that he was at, Calvary was the last one here in McAllister. It's a preacher's fault. He always got into it with the preacher. And he'd say, the preacher wants me to do something I don't feel like the Lord's leading me to do. And I'd tell Mama, that's kind of strange, ain't it, Mama? And I think some things happened. And my grandson was going to Calvary. And he told me, Mimi, he said, a lady come up to me one time and said, Joe acts kind of funny around these kids, don't he? He's kind of odd or something. He said, well, I thought it was public notice that he had been turned in. He said, well, he is a pedophile. And she said, really? And he said, yeah. And she said, well, she said, I confided in Joe that I've had drug problems and I've come to the Lord and I'm doing better. And she said, Joe leaned over to her and said, I have a problem, pornography, and I still struggle with it. That was just about 4 or 5 years ago. And that's what my grandson told me here about a year ago. And it's like, oh my gosh. So I'm not sure. And the churches sometimes don't want to talk about it. But I think somebody needs to, and we told this to Westbrook, the investigator at the Sheriff's Department in McAllister. Somebody ought to go investigate and talk to that pastor or some of the people in that church. I have a feeling they might find out some stuff. And then he was in a church over Longtown area. There's a church over there. There was a church there, a Baptist church. He was music director at. He got into it with the pastor again. Out in Florida, he was making good money. And all of a sudden, he up and left, and they moved back here, and they've been back here ever since.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. We had learned from one alleged victim who came forward directly to us that she had reported her abuse to not just one, but three law enforcement agencies, including one report that was made by her therapist as a mandatory reporter under Oklahoma law. She also made a report to the Fort Worth Police Department, who you may remember from the Carolyn Riggins series we shared with you last year. We contacted the chief of police and notified him that a victim was making allegations of a decade of abuse that took place primarily in the city of Fort Worth, Texas. The victim had reported to us that she had been blown off by the Fort Worth Police Department and that the burden had been placed on her to provide medical records before investigators would take further action. This not only traumatized the victim so severely that she was afraid to talk to any law enforcement officer or investigator from any agency, but she also expressed to us that she felt like Joe would never be held accountable because she didn't have the proof that police had asked her to obtain, and she didn't know where to find it because her family had moved many times during her childhood. The chief of police did not respond to us at all, nor did he respond to Teresa's sister-in-law and Bethany's aunt, Melissa, for almost 2 weeks. When he did respond, he sent the following email to Melissa. "My apologies for the delayed response. I'm going to have someone reach out to you to discuss your case. We definitely take matters like this very seriously and never want to hear about a minor being abused in any way. We have to agree with Chief Noakes. It's become quite clear to us over the last few years that we've interacted with the Fort Worth Police Department that they never want to hear about anything. In fact, this sentiment was once again cemented in our minds through our own conversations with officers from the Fort Worth Police Department regarding this case, which we're going to share with you today. After reaching out directly to the original officer assigned to the victim's case to ask for a status update, we received a phone call from Mr. Brian Burns, who was no longer assigned to the Crimes Against Children Unit, but still employed in a sworn capacity with the Fort Worth Police Department. We had to record the audio without any time to prepare, so the quality isn't the best. But we felt that sharing it with you was so important, to really delving into what the victims who tried to come forward must have felt. How Melissa felt when she didn't get a response for 13 days. And when she did, it was a terse, 3-sentence email with not a lot of promise. We asked Mr. Burns to explain why the investigation had stalled in October of 2020, when he told us that his last note left in the case file indicated the police were waiting on the victim to provide medical records, and no follow-up in 15 months since. Hear for yourself how he responded.
Well, I explained what I requested from the victim and where I stand with it. If, you know, I requested the information and from the victim, and that's the last I've heard from her. I don't know how to explain it to you any other way other than I requested information from the victim that any way I proceed with the case, to talk to the suspect or to present it to a district attorney or all that, I have to have answers to where certain pieces of information I've been told are available or at. If they're unavailable to the victim or any of that, I need to have answers to that. Or, you know, it's her medical records, and she can get a copy of those medical records. So things that have, you know, since she's become an adult that she has done, you know, I'm not being provided that information. So any way to proceed with this case, I need to have an answer to that of where these are at. Have we tried to get these, you know, or if they're unavailable? So that's where I'm at with it. It's not the not talking to a suspect or something like that. I just want to have this information to be able to back up.
We knew that there was no reason police couldn't call Joe and ask him if he would voluntarily speak with police. So we asked Mr. Burns why he didn't just give Joe a call. There was nothing preventing him from doing so.
Once again, there is information that I have requested from the victim that for me to proceed forward with this case, I would like to have as much information as possible before I go and speak with somebody else about it, an alleged suspect or something like that. And I haven't been provided that information I requested. I haven't got, you know, heard anything else back from the victim or anything like that to let me know where she's at with those medical records. They're her medical records. There are things that are in place that prevent me from just calling up and getting certain types of information. And that's where, you know, I have to have either permission from
a victim to get that information, or a victim gets that information for me and then provides me with that information. I'm limited in what I can do on getting that information that will help me proceed forward with this case.
This call was frustrating. It felt like we were going around in circles about the victim needing to provide her medical records, which, as previously stated, the victim didn't even know where to start finding those records because she was moved around so frequently during childhood. Instead of assisting or advocating for this person who had bravely come forward to report heinous sexual abuse, they made her feel as though it was her job to prove it by hunting down all of her medical records. This call took place in January of 2022, several days prior to the chief's email to Melissa, leaving us unsure whether or not we could ethically air these episodes without causing even further and deeper trauma to those who had already endured so much, only to be further traumatized when they tried to do what many people don't do for this exact reason: report their victimization to police. The day after Melissa received a response, we got a call from another detective who works in the Crimes Against Children unit currently. This is how our conversation with him started out.
I was assigned a case, I guess from 2020, that Detective Burns was covering, and my office got contacted by Melissa, and she said to contact you. So, here's what I would like to do. Because, like you said, you're doing podcasts and all that kind of stuff, and aren't like physically, familially related to the victim. So any information, any journals, anything like that, that you can provide me would be awesome. I'm happy to take a look at them. Part of my concern is this. I'm happy to look into it. I'm happy to, I listened to the audio, interviews that, Detective Burns had with also with her sister. And I'm not Detective Burns. I'll say that. And I feel like the case is pretty decent, even from the information that we have. That being said, I personally would like to interview again. I hate to have to rehash that again, but there's some pretty important questions that I think are relevant to the case that would be necessary for me to pursue charges if that's something she's wanting to do. I would like to talk to her. I'd like to talk to her sister and to anybody else that can kind of fill me in on some important information. Due to the fact that it sounds like this case occurred over 20 years ago, it's not something that we can't pursue, but obviously I would have to have cooperation with the victim, and I'm not saying she hasn't or isn't willing to. Sounds like she's had some trauma between this and then just not getting possibly the results she was looking for. I am happy to talk to her and reach out to her and do whatever I can to help help her and help her with this case. But I do have to have obviously some minor cooperation. So in regards to hospital medical records, all that kind of stuff, it's something we can consider looking at. I'm not super concerned about that.
Detective Runyon indicated more interest in pursuing justice for the victim who came forward to the Fort Worth police than the previously assigned officer. But we couldn't help but notice how hesitant he seemed to really want to take on this case and find the truth and justice. At one point in our conversation, things became particularly tense.
With contacting, how would you, here's the thing. You can tell me what to or not to do, but regardless, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. So I would recommend you contact her as soon as possible and find out what she would like to do in regards to speaking with me regarding this case. But like I said, you are not family. You're not her lawyer. So there's no obligation whatsoever for us to have you to participate, you know. I'm happy, and I'm happy if that's something that's the only way that she will speak with me, and this is something she's wanting to pursue, it's something we can consider. But that being said, again, not family, not lawyer. She's a full consenting adult. But if she is truly wanting to pursue charges, I'm sorry that both of y'all have had negative experiences with Fort Worth Police Department and with other sergeants and detectives and whatnot. But all I can do is offer my help and assistance. And if that is not enough, then there's only so much I can do. Any journals or any documentation you think that's relevant that would be helpful for the case, if you don't mind sending it to me, I would appreciate it. If you have any audio that you want to share, I would appreciate it.
Detective Runyon was right. The police had no obligation to talk to us, even though that was the request made by Joe's own family members. We also are not lawyers, nor did we claim to be representing the family in any legal capacity. But after the detective asked us to hand over our months of hard work, interviewing and researching and talking with the victims who came forward to us, we thought back to the origins of how this conversation came about. The victims had come forward to us because they felt they were failed by law enforcement. Police could order us to give them our work, but we held one thing they would have to work really hard to overcome, especially given that almost 2 years had passed since the first victim reported her abuse to the Fort Worth PD. She and her family had placed their trust and confidence in us. We had to make a concerted effort to do what was right, and that was to ensure we threw our hearts into this the same way we do when working with every family. And in this case, that meant giving the police the work we had done, and hoping that maybe this time, the Fort Worth Police Department would do something, despite past experience. And we were happy to turn over our work to them if it meant that something would be done to bring justice. But we couldn't help but wonder why they hadn't interviewed Joe's family members in nearly 2 years since this was reported to them. Not only to do what was right in regards to the victims who reported their abuse, but also to protect other children in Joe Tyner's life.
I haven't met her. I haven't talked to her. I've heard her interview. If she's not willing to testify in court, she's not capable of doing that, that's definitely something that needs to be accounted for. And the same thing with her family, anybody that's willing to speak with me. I'm happy to talk with them, happy to go the extra mile as best I can. But, you know, in the long run, we do have to have, there is potential of court. And that is something that is real, and we can't just put off like it's not never going to happen. So I know with child victims, because of age and circumstances, it's a little different, her being an adult. But I mean, you know, with trauma and PTSD and all the things she's going through, I mean, we have to have the opportunity to face our accuser.
Once we had fulfilled our due diligence in reporting the alleged abuse to federal authorities with more resources and wider jurisdiction, we refocused on our original mission, and that was to tell the story that Catherine had held inside for decades. Some might say that Catherine is lucky, because she was spared the abuse that Joe allegedly perpetrated against so many others. But she was also abused in an entirely different manner, and her victimization is no less important or severe, simply because it was of another nature. In fact, the abuse Catherine shared with us that she endured at the hands of her stepmother affected her well into adulthood.
The only positive memories that I have of Kelly are tainted by the negative memories that came after. Pretty early on, I recognized a pattern with Kelly, which was that she would be nice to me and cause me to let my guard down and make me emotionally vulnerable to her so that she could say something cutting to hurt my feelings. And because I had my guard down, it would hurt me that much more. Kelly was extremely emotionally abusive. She loved to talk to me about my pretty hair and how she was going to take me shopping and we were going to get all these new clothes for me. And then when we got to the store, I was too big for her to buy clothes for. And so she wouldn't buy me anything. And she would buy my sister's clothes because they were skinnier than I was. That was essentially Kelly's message. Like, just if you weren't so fat, then maybe you could have nice things. This is kind of embarrassing to admit, but right now, 2022, my New Year's resolution was to stop counting calories and to stop counting macros. And I'm 32 years old. I have counted calories or macronutrients or restricted my food consumption in some way since I was 12 years old. Kelly put me on my first diet, the Atkins diet, when I was 14 years old. And I am just now learning how to eat without counting or restricting or feeling guilty for eating. I fell into this unhealthy eating pattern for decades, I guess, of starving and then binging and then starving and then binging. I stopped eating in front of people when I was in the fifth grade, I think, or the sixth grade. I stopped eating lunch at school because I believed that everybody else at school was thinking the same things that Kelly was saying to me, which was that I was fat and I shouldn't be eating. And so I would like hoard snacks in my bedroom and then not eat. I would barely eat at dinner. And then after everyone else was asleep, I would have my moment to eat my snacks in peace. And isn't it such a shame that intelligent adults with so much value to bring to the world have such a large part of their brain sort of held captive by this topic of like calories or food? It's just so tragic. Like if we had just been allowed to do what every human does, which is fuel when they need fuel.
The events that have transpired for Catherine over the last year alone have turned her life upside down. But she addressed this in what may be the most healthy manner someone can, by courageously confronting the problems with her therapist. We asked her to look back at the last year, and all that has taken place after years passing by with no news or developments about what happened to her mom and sister. This is what she told us.
Well, it's kind of hard for me to put everything into words. So one big thing for me personally is after we talked initially, I reached out to a therapist and I actually just completed the treatment for PTSD, which at the time that I reached out, I didn't think that I had PTSD. I just thought I had anxiety and wanted to talk about these issues. But the therapist diagnosed me with PTSD and really helped me. It was a very eye-opening process. And then this is something that tortured me really early on. I've lain awake many nights wondering what is wrong with my father and why he was compelled to do this. And, you know, there's tons of excuses you could make. You could just put it all the blame on him and his own personal choices. And, you know, he just judge him as a terrible person. But I cannot think of any excuses for a mother. Like, I am a mother. The number one impulse of a human mother is to protect the child. Like, I just can't. You know, it really gets me, like, just sitting here that the story from my stepmother was that my mother was a terrible person. My mother was a lesbian. My mother abandoned me. My mother was irresponsible. And my mother had the common decency to protect her baby from a child molester, from a baby molester, because in my head, a three-year-old is still a baby.
My dad is three people in my mind. He's, first of all, the person that I knew when I was little, and we played video games together, and we were really close, and we both suffered through this trauma of losing Teresa and Bethany together. And then there was my dad after he married my stepmom, when it seemed to me that his personality changed and he became very distant and kind of very stressed and busy and always working. And then there is the version of my dad that has been told to me by my stepsister, which is as somebody who assaulted a child sexually. So to me, I can't squish all these three people together. I just found out this last version of my dad a year or two ago. This was right before 2020, you know, pandemic, which affected my family a lot. When it comes to the disappearance of my mother and sister, I know that I never dealt with that because when I was a kid, I remember that I made a conscious decision that I just wasn't going to let it bother me. And basically, all the way up until like very recently, until a couple years ago, I pretended like either I never had a mother or she had died. I just never ever even thought about her disappearance, let alone talked about it with anyone really. So I definitely know that even that is still something that it has to be affecting me because I haven't ever really done anything to deal with it. I think one of the hardest things for me,
after learning this was how much I loved my dad and being angry at myself or judging myself for loving basically a monster. And this is one reason why I haven't spoken to him since I found out. But one of my recent realizations is that it's okay for me to love anybody. That doesn't make, you know, what he did okay. But like, there's never, at least I don't believe that there's ever anything bad about loving. So I do still have love for my dad because he was there for me. But on the other hand, I still know that he, or I believe, because I believe my sister, my stepsister, I believe that he's a bad person. So that's why I have decided not to interact with him anymore. Finding this out about my dad, you know, it caused me to start looking at my whole childhood in a completely different way. Like, this was a huge secret that everybody in my family knew, apparently, except for me.
I don't think I'm done dealing with that, because even if I wasn't abused, there's another basket of questions that comes up for me. Maybe they're not logical, but they still come up. One of them is, you know, how did I not know? How did I not see? And another one is, if there's this thing wrong with him, is there something wrong with me? And those are just the first two that come up. It's one of those things where you have to, I think you just have to be patient with yourself and tell yourself logically, like I tell myself, self, you were a child. You were dealing with a lot of other stuff, and it's really easy to trick children. It's really easy to manipulate children and hide things from them.
Teresa and Bethany still haven't been found. So what's next for Catherine in finding healing for her own abuse, grieving the abuse of her relatives, and continuing to search for her mother and sister?
Obviously, I support justice being done. And there was one time when I was 11 years old that my stepmom, Kelly, told me that my dad had an addiction to porn, which at that time I barely even knew what that was. In hindsight, I realized the kind of porn that it must have been, and there's no telling how many victims have just gone, you know, by the wayside because they didn't care enough to actually dig into their case. Ultimately, my goals here have been, number one, to find my mother and sister, and if they feel safe to come forward, that would be ideal. That would be kind of be like the dream scenario. I don't really expect it, but obviously some part of me is hoping for it.
We often reach the end of production on a story and feel what we can only imagine our listeners also feel, and we know the families feel as well. What if the police had done more, faster, or sometimes just anything at all? This case is no different because Teresa and Bethany are still missing. So many times we walk away frustrated that decades have passed and those loved by so many haven't been found or even really looked for. But in this case, there's a small victory for the good guys. On February 23, 2022, Joe Tyner was taken into custody by local law enforcement in Oklahoma. Authorities in Texas filed felony charges against Joe Tyner for indecency with a minor and other related sex offenses. Joe was extradited to Texas on March 4, 2022, where he remains in custody as of the time these episodes were originally recorded. Joe's arrest was only one small step forward. Joe Tyner has not yet been convicted of any crime, and we would like to reiterate that the charges filed remain only allegations of criminal offenses at the time these episodes were recorded. Under constitutional protections, he is innocent until proven guilty via a plea before a judge or a conviction by a judge or jury of his peers. However, Joe's arrest was a major shift for Catherine. If what Teresa Kennedy said in her December 1996 letter is true, could she still be out there with Bethany in hiding? This is what Catherine told us in an interview just days after Joe's arrest.
A major thing since we talked, my father was recently arrested, which is huge for me. Kind of mind-blowing. And that's incredible. And that was facilitated by you, somebody who cares way more than the average person. But I've always thought about how many of these cases and to what extent this case for so many years has just gone undetected because nobody was really incentivized to care. And then also, you know, so that my dad doesn't harm anyone else ever again. That's another amazing goal that seems to have been achieved here. This experience has been a roller coaster for me because when I initially submitted the case, you contacted me way sooner than I expected. And then, you know, we kind of had a dialogue for a short time, and then for a long time it was nothing, and it kind of went on, kind of stalled for a while because of the investigation on my dad. And now it's like everything is coming back to the surface again. For months, you know, after I had spoken with you, I kind of expected that maybe, you know, you wouldn't be able to do the story, you know, whether that was from lack of interviews or because of the investigation. So learning all of a sudden that the show is going to be aired on the podcast and that my dad has been arrested and my mom is probably alive. It's just, it's insane. Like, it's just totally turned my world upside down. It's really, really hard to describe the way I feel about my dad. Objectively, I understand that he's a monster and he attacked young girls' children. But my lived experience of him is a completely different story. When I was growing up, my dad was my savior. He protected me against my stepmom. So yeah, I'm not afraid of my dad even now. The only thing I feel is I actually feel sorry for him, even though I know that there's really no reason to feel sorry for him. He brought this on himself. So as far as how it feels to know that he has been arrested, I feel sad because he's old and now he's a grandpa. And when I was younger, for most of my life, I always hoped that he could make more of his life. You know, he is a composer, he's a pianist, and I always hoped that he would get himself together, like his motivation or his discipline, whatever he needed to gin up in order to make more of his career. And that's actually the way that I've thought of him for most of my adult life, is just hoping that he would still have more of a successful career. And when you contrast that perspective to, oh, now he's probably going to spend the rest of his life in prison, it's pretty bizarre. I still haven't computed it.
So what happened to Teresa Kennedy and Bethany Tyner in early 1997? Was Teresa really dating Rachel, a woman who had been adopted by Teresa's parents as an adult, just weeks before Teresa wrote the letter disclosing that Joe had abused Bethany? The timing of that adoption, the letter, and their subsequent disappearances shortly thereafter seems like it must have been planned. As we discussed in part one of this story, was Rachel actually part of the plan to help Teresa and Bethany escape and get to safety? And what happened to Rachel? We weren't able to find any information about her disappearance, and it almost seems as though she came to rescue Teresa and Bethany and then left them safely away in hiding. We never found any of Rachel's relatives or anyone who could speak about who she was, besides Catherine, who remembered Rachel moving into the Tyner house, and the stories her father told her that Rachel and Teresa were in a romantic relationship. We also have the conversations between Catherine and Teresa's younger sister Regina, who we were ultimately never able to connect with, who we believe may hold more knowledge about Rachel and their disappearances than she shared. With Joe incarcerated and unable to contact or harm anyone, the possibility that Teresa and Bethany may be alive out there somewhere is one that has come into increasingly clearer focus for us. And our ultimate goal is that they now feel safe enough to come out of hiding without fear of further abuse, victimization, or retribution. For Catherine, having the answers as to what happened and her mother and sister safe and alive would be the life-changing event that every family we work with holds out hope for. If you have any information about the disappearances of Teresa Kennedy, Bethany Tyner, or Rachel Lewis, we encourage you to contact the Chickasha Police Department at 405-222-6050. You may also reach out to federal authorities with the U.S. Marshals Service in the Western District of Oklahoma at 405-231-4206. You can also contact the Department of Homeland Security, Dallas Field Office at 214-424-7800. You can follow Teresa and Bethany's story on the website that Catherine has created and maintained in her own search for information. That's findbethandmom.com. If you or a loved one are the victim of sexual assault, or have reason to believe someone you know is being victimized, please consider reaching out to the RAIN Network, available 24 hours a day at 1-800-656-4673.
He come over here right after Kathy left, April or May, anyway, this last year. And he come over here and he said, all smiles and everything, and he said, I've asked Mama, our mother, to help me get a lawyer, retain a lawyer. I looked at him and I smiled and I said, you ain't getting one damn penny from her. I said, go hawk your house. He got mad. I thought he was going to blow up. His face got so red. His eyes got red and he got mad. And then we started in on about how he's molested. And he molested my daughter and my granddaughter. And I hate to even say what he said. He said, your girls called me. The girls would say, let's have F sex. I said, you're sick, but he said the word. And he said, they enticed me. That's an omission right there. I said, you sick bastard. I said, you are sick. My kids, she can't talk about it. She said, well, it freaks me out. Because he would say that's what families do. And that he loved her. And that, you know, it was all good and fine. And so she never told me for a long time until all this other pretty well come out. And then it was like, oh, my God. But then he says, my girls enticed him. I go, what are you talking about, Joey? My mother, Mama said, she told Melissa, Melissa told me, Kelly called Mama in the middle of the night and said, Joey's doing it again. Caught him, molested one of the girls. I said, Mama, what did you say? She said, I told her, why are you calling me? Take care of it. I don't know. Why didn't Kelly call the cops? And I wonder why she called Mama to tell her that, knowing she was just going to help and help him. And how can she sit there and watch that and allow that? I'd like for Kathy to find her mother and get some solace and get some answers and get to see her mother and her sister Beth.
Just a quick update to this story. As you can tell, these events were rapidly unfolding as we were producing these episodes. Just when we thought this story couldn't get any more unbelievable, in the days after these episodes were produced, we learned that Joe's bond had been significantly reduced to only a fraction of what it had been set at originally. Joe has since posted bond and is currently awaiting trial. We will continue to follow this story as it develops, and hope to bring you an update in the future. That brings us to the end of episode 337. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story, especially the victims who bravely came forward to report their horrific abuse when it felt like law enforcement wasn't interested, and told their stories to us, repeating the nightmare they've endured over and over once again. We would like to thank the hard work of law enforcement officers across the nation, from the Department of Homeland Security and the United States Marshal Service, who worked together with local law enforcement agencies so that we were able to end this episode with a beacon of hope. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at The Vanished Pod and also on Instagram. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be covering a case from Alabama. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.